Spirituality Challenged is a podcast recorded on Canadian Treaty 1 territory, and that the land on which we gather is the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, Cree, Oji-Cree, Dakota, and Dene people, and the homeland of the Métis Nation. We acknowledge that our water is sourced from Shoal Lake 41st Nation, which is located on Treaty 3 territory. Spirituality Challenged respects the spirit and intent of treaties and treaty making and are open to future partnerships with First Nations, Inuit, and Métis people in the spirit of truth, reconciliation, and collaboration. I went through a rough 2002. I was kicked out of high school for trying to radicalize them by getting my so-called Christian rap played at school dances without paying admission. And I reamed out the vice principal when he tried to stop me from continuing to do so at future dances. Today, if I did that, I probably would have been considered the next Kyle Rittenhouse, especially if this story went viral in the media. But back then, Christian nationalism was looked down upon in the era of George W. Bush, so my parents decided to take me to a psychiatrist. This doctor diagnosed me with ASD, and for the listener who wants to speak more updated language, we're talking about autism. Of course, now feel free to cover your ears, because ASD back then was Asperger's syndrome. But today, I would be called autistic. Looking back all those years ago, dear listener, I still believe I'm neurodiverse. But I'm struggling with whether or not autism is my actual issue, even though it's my identity. I sometimes think that I was just ahead of my time. Back then, I was praying that the internet would develop a better way of getting my music out to my classmates besides using GeoCities sites. While I didn't come up with the concept of YouTube, SoundCloud, or Bandcamp, if those sites actually existed back in the early 2000s, I probably would have used them and given links out to my classmates instead of trying to get a DJ at a school dance to play my tracks. Back at that time, I knew getting those things built myself was impossible, so I tried to promote myself the only way I knew how. If you listen to one of my bonus episodes, you'll understand I've had some really messed up ideas about the world around me. So regardless of what would have happened if social media existed or not when I was in high school, I probably would have needed some kind of assistance to get myself out there. I think that if I knew what I know now about the history of mental health, autism, and Christian nationalism, things would have been different for me. Anyway, enough of this cold opening nonsense. Let's cue the introduction. Welcome to Spirituality Challenge, dear listener. I am your host, Aaron Parsons. On this podcast, we uncover the rarely discussed history and expose sources behind controversial Christian ideologies while speaking truth to power. We try to cover as much ground within an hour on one topic in each episode, so sit back, relax, and prepare to be challenged. Disability is a complicated topic to discuss. Often, how we look at disability is because of societal expectations rather than individual conditions. I understand how careful I have to be when doing this episode, and sometimes I need to be a bit more self-aware of my personal bias that may possibly come out, which could cause a few dear listeners to give into outrage or stop listening to me altogether. I also understand that almost everyone sees autism and mental health with a very wide spectrum of difference and opinion. However, I believe this episode is for anyone listening who experiences issues with autism and mental health who may agree with what I'm about to address. So, here's how I view myself as an autistic, not a person with autism, an autistic. Here's how I see neurodiversity. I believe autism and other neurological variations, or learning disabilities, ADHD, bipolar, etc., they may be disabilities, but they are not weaknesses or flaws. Here's a question I want to ask the next person I see who claims they are disabled. Who told you you were broken? I really want to ask them this because I know people who claim to be neurodiverse and they deeply accept their neurological differences as part of their identity. They believe they are not broken when they really, really think about who they are. And they don't see themselves as incomplete. And that's what I strongly agree with. I believe that disability, no matter how profound, doesn't and in fact shouldn't diminish personhood. Folks with atypical brains are fully human and they deserve human dignity just like everyone else. And like everyone else, these people can live rich, full, meaningful lives with employment that brings in a good income, happy marriages, and they can also have children that are equally unique. Lastly, just like every human has physical variations of size, shape, and skin color, neurology and personality also have a massive spectrum of variation as well. And those variations are a vital part of humanity. No one, not even myself, has the wisdom or the right to try and improve upon our species by deciding which characteristics to keep and which to discard. Every person, disabled or neurodiverse, is valuable. However, this is not to say that we're all a little neurodiverse. I could go on about this all day, but I think you want me to get into the history of things, right, dear listener? Great. Let's go back to ancient time. Like physical health, mental health has a significant impact on our well-being, and especially among Gen Z and millennials. With these groups, it's become a big issue that should be addressed more often. 200 years ago, mental illness didn't draw a lot of sympathy from the general population, and in much of the Western world, like France, Britain, and other places they colonized, the neurodiverse were ignored and kept in confinement. If you listen to this podcast long enough, dear listener, I don't have to expand on the idea that in ancient times, early beliefs in what the West now classifies as mental illness revolved around the idea that victims were possessed by demons. Treatments for these so-called problems didn't involve casting out spirits, but they also involved the use of charms and mystic items like amulets and special placement of various kinds of stones that possessed magical powers. Soon after, the Christian church gained institutional power, and this began to discourage non-parish membership to use many kinds of folk remedies which were deemed unorthodox or associated with witchcraft. This caused society to see individuals with mental illness as wild beasts that needed to be locked up. Society also employed unspeakable practices and treatment of the so-called mentally ill for hundreds of years. Institutions like the Bethlehem Hospital in the 13th century and the Salpetriere Hospital in the 17th century kept the quote-unquote insane in their buildings, never to be seen by regular citizens. As mental health continued to be so-called studied, the general public believed asylums were buildings where the mentally ill could be nursed back to health. Thus, the institutions, unironically and poorly titled madhouses, were rendered prisons and showed little regard for any patient's human dignity. This perspective made institutions look more like hospitals, while implying that mental illness can be cured like a physical ailment. But progress prevailed from here, or so it seems. In the 19th century, some physicians opened private asylums in their lavish homes. This was a step up from those struggling with mental health that European reformers Philippe Pinel and William Tuke pushed for society. Pinel and Tuke advocated for moral therapy, which is the creation of a pleasant environment that can help reduce the suffering of those with mental struggles. The dominant view of medical professions back then was that problems in the nervous system caused mental illness. And sadly, dear listener, to repair the nervous system, these two madmen advocated for the use and gave us electroshock therapy. The mid-19th century saw a shift in attitudes towards the mentally ill that began to change for the worst. This is where things will start to get dark in this episode, dear listener. We're going to be covering the developing views of eugenicists while connecting the dots from degeneration theory, Hitler, James Dobson, and Andrew Wakefield. Please take care while listening to this episode. So let's try and go through degeneration theory as quickly as possible. In the 18th century, a few thought leaders believed that humans had degenerated over time because of what we know today as climate change. Because of the immigration from Europe to America, they concluded that because America was colder and more moist than Europe, the differences in climate created variations within many species in the New World. But more importantly, it made humans much more vulnerable. At least that's how alpha males see it. They also believed in the falsehood that indigenous people lacked the ability to feel strong emotions like love and anger. Many people disagreed with this view of the New World and how it would negatively influence European perceptions of America, and also Thomas Jefferson tried to debunk most of these poorly defined theories. But while doing this debunking, it only resulted in the expansion of ideas through Johann Friedrich Blumenbach, who not only expanded on how North American climate affected humans and animals, but also concluded that all people of the world existed as different gradations on a spectrum because of the New World's physical environment. And then there's Immanuel Kant, and that is spelled with a K, not C-U. Kant argued that humans shared a common origin and that humans interbred with each other because of this. Kant gave eugenics the term degeneration, which he defined as hereditary differences between groups with a shared origin, which also gave us the meaning of race. And the concept of race itself came from this very definition of degeneration, because Kant thinks that certain races develop with qualities that degenerate over a long period of time. According to Kant, a group could only constitute a race if breeding with a different degeneration resulted in intermediate offspring. Kant wrote that a human's place in nature was determined by the amount of sweat the individual produced, which revealed that an individual's chance of survival was either at a high rate or a low rate. A century later, development of world trade, colonialism, and the early European experience of globalization resulted in an awareness of varieties of cultural expression and at the same time vulnerabilities of Western civilization. And unfortunately, the vulnerabilities that I'm referring to here are from the documents I read, which actually indicates vulnerabilities of humans, not societies of oppression. This led to fears of hereditary taint, which caused concepts of degeneration theory to be linked to authoritarian attitudes, scientific racism, and eugenics itself. All this leads to Francis Galton, the half-cousin of Charles Darwin. Galton's studies in the beginning meant to study hereditary genius. He studied family trees and found that families passed success down through multiple generations. He believed that people with excellent thinking, vision, or hearing were the smartest and the most exceptional in the population. However, he also measured intelligence by sensitivity to high-pitched noises, color perception, and reaction time to various types of stimulus. Research eventually showed sensory tests were unrelated to mental ability, and his mental tests were considered failures. However, he coined the phrase nature versus nurture, which caught on when discussing hereditary environment studies.
That is no escape from the conclusion that nature prevails enormously over nurture when the differences in nurture do not exceed what is commonly to be found among persons of the same rank of society and in the same country.
Galton encouraged healthy, able-bodied people with above-average intelligence to pop out more babies to quote-unquote improve the human race. This encouraged Alfred Bennett to create tests that identify children who were quote-unquote mentally stable. It also encouraged David Welschler to create psychology assessments for adult patients struggling with mental health. Unfortunately, Galton was the one who also coined the term eugenics, which he defines as being well-born. This leads us to the negative use of eugenics itself, a time when the higher class wasn't having as many children as the poor or working class. Galton's views on genetics reinforced the prejudices of class and race. It deemed those with desirable genetic traits are white, healthy, and rich, while on the other hand, those with traits no one wanted back then were identified as colored, of lower economic status, or were physically or mentally disabled. In addition, criminals and those that were deemed sexually deviant were judged as those with poor genetics. There was even a subdivision of desirable European traits as well. Those with a Northern and Western European heritage were deemed desirable, while those that were from Southern and Eastern Europe were deemed undesirable. At the dawn of the 20th century, leaders in the United States saw the continued decline in the number of pure white folks being born and began to discuss the non-existent issue of racial suicide. President Roosevelt wrote a letter to Pastor Franklin Smith in 1911 about this issue.
To advocate artificially keeping families small with its inevitable attendance of prenatal infanticide, abortion with its pandering to self-indulgence, its shirking of duties, and its enervation of character is quite as immoral as to advocate theft or prostitution, and is even more hurtful in its folly from the standpoint of the ultimate welfare of the race and the nation. You say that your ministry lies among well-to-do people, that is, among people of means and upper-class workers. I assume that you regard these people as desirable elements in the state. Can you not see that if they have an insufficient quality of children, then the increase must come from the less desirable classes?
This line of thinking spread among white fundamentalist churches, and one example of this was Billy Sunday, often found preaching against the so-called takeover of non-whites.
I am against one godforsaken, vicious, corrupt man and woman to breed and propagate and damn the world by their offspring. Children have a right to be born cleanly into the world and not be damned into the world before birth by a predetermined heritage of blight.
This kind of thinking did not sit well with everyone. Back then, eugenics and evangelicalism can be seen as incompatible since the early 1900s. The evangelicals back then opposed sterilization for obvious reasons. They also didn't support it because of Galton's relationship to Charles Darwin due to his involvement with evolutionary theory. But they did support other kinds of eugenics, such as early immigration restrictions and so-called responsible breeding. The American eugenics movement also inspired the German eugenics movement. Germany's movement also began at the beginning of the 20th century and grew quite quickly towards the rise of the Third Reich. Certain principles, like the life unworthy of life principle, were critical components of national eugenics ideology for purifying German people with Nordic bloodlines. In 1933, one of the first pieces of legislation that was passed after Hitler seized power was the Law for the Prevention of Genetically Diseased Offspring. People with schizophrenia, deafness, blindness, epilepsy, Huntington's disease, and other conditions that were deemed genetic, like undiagnosed autism, for example, were sterilized because of this law. But there was an issue behind this sterilization, and the issue was that it had a zealous objective to preserve desired genes. The issue also came to the point where certain diseases took effect after reproductive age, and that the sterilization didn't actually help any towards their zealous cause. A couple of years later, there was a short propaganda film called The Inheritance released in Germany. In this film, A young scientist studies two male stag beetles in a fight for a mate. Confused by the sparring, she has a chat with her professor, who then teaches her the Darwinian struggles for life. The teacher proceeds to show her a film of a cat looking for birds as prey while two roosters are fighting for a mate, just like the stag beetles. Suddenly, watching the film clicks in her mind, and the scientist concludes that the animals pursue their own racial policies. The message of the film was simple. Nature purges the weak, and so must the superior. The film later puts shocking images of seriously disabled people in mental institutions on screen, and it cuts away to healthy marching German soldiers. What follows is a message from Hitler.
He who is physically and mentally not healthy and worthy may not perpetuate his suffering in the body of his child.
Approximately 400,000 people were sterilized under this nasty policy. A scientific lie had become a pillar of genocide in just 20 years as the Second World War waged on from the Axis countries. The development of Nazi eugenics programs was supported intellectually and financially by American eugenicists. One eugenicist we're going to cover today not only helped inspire Hitler's eugenics program indirectly, but also shaped the family values of the religious right that we know of today. This man was Paul Popenoe. An atheist from California, Popenoe had been one of the most passionate advocates for the segregation and forced sterilization of people who he deemed waste humanity. Later on, he rebranded into a defender of procreative marriage and patriarchy. In 1930, Popenoe started the American Institute of Family Relations in Los Angeles to remove what he thought were reproductive issues and whatever prevented marital harmony. He targeted early feminist desires, pornography, wives who don't seduce their husbands, and marital rape. Over the next several decades, Popenoe counseled couples on why strict gender norms and same-race marriage were important. Now, why is Paul Popenoe important? Because he trained Baptist and Mormon pastors, youth pastors, and other church leaders and psychologists in his quote-unquote racial betterment projects to lead their organizations with those same complementarian values. And one of those values were that the nuclear family was important, and that men need to be the head of the house, while women were to submit to their husbands sexually. And one of those psychologists that Mr. Atheist Popenoe trained was the most famous Christian psychologist that shaped the family values of white evangelicals, Dr. James Dobson. So, I get that this is a pretty big bombshell for some of you dear listeners. So we're just going to back up a bit, park here, and do a quick review from the 18th century forward. So, early thought leaders determined climate change caused people to start breaking down while forming more diverse races. Physical and intelligent tests were created to see who has better genes, qualities, and what races were better than others. Then, these tests cemented prejudices of class and race. Then, America and Germany tried to sterilize disabled and people who were not considered normal. Then, an atheist influenced not just German and American World War eugenics, but the foundation of American nuclear family values and male and female marriage roles. Wow. All I gotta say, given the information you just heard, after putting it all together, if anyone from a church tells me that children need a Leave It to Beaver nuclear family, or that the family is a divine institution of the church, I only have one reply for the person who utters one of those statements. Go know yourself biblically. Before the 1980s, James Dobson found the organization Focus on the Family. This organization put out tons of literature and ran a radio program that was known as the Crusade for the Christian Home. Dobson's project was dedicated to putting out literature that would teach puberty and abstinence to teens from a Christian perspective while explaining why going to third base and masturbating was wrong. He would start a kids show called Odyssey that was both in radio and video format that would teach kids Christian lessons as an alternative to Saturday morning cartoons. He would put out literature like a plugged-in newsletter explaining what shows were okay to watch and what shows had sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And some of the issues of plugged-in even counted the number of F-bombs that were dropped in certain films. And Dobson would go on the radio to share his views on current events and how to use nuclear family values and complementarianism to push back against what back then were considered woke values. And yes, my parents still have some of Dobson's radio shows and plugged-in issues today. But here's where things get more sinister when it comes to Focus on the Family. Dobson would also instruct other counselors and other psychologists to encourage their peer groups to support and enforce what was called interpersonal compatibility. This was coded language for keeping white people from marrying and having children with colored folks, which was even encouraged while racism was looked down upon in the late 80s and 90s. Yet, this particular mindset has also influenced Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, and Ronald Reagan to amplify the anti-abortion movement, which had the original purpose of raising funds to keep Christian colleges open. These colleges strongly discouraged white and black Christian students from dating, marrying, and having children with each other. But when it came to couples where both the husband and wife were white, the schools advised them to have as many children as possible. We're going to go back a bit and focus on autism specifically. Autism itself was identified separately by Leo Kanner and Hans Asperger, and I'm very sorry for those who hear the name like Asperger is Voldemort due to his association with Nazis, but this is part of the history that we do have to cover in order for me to get some points across. Asperger studied more than 200 children whom he would treat for what he termed as autistic psychopathy. He found some of those children struggling in school, while others suffered greater disabilities and were put in institutions. However, he concluded that among those kids, there were common symptoms such as social awkwardness, an intense focus on rules and law and schedules, and special heightened abilities. Kanner, on the other hand, was a psychiatrist who concluded autism was unique, only affecting children. He believed its cause was cold parenting styles, and by making it the fault of the parents, autism became a source of shame and stigma for families everywhere. And in that shame, parents started to look for ways to cure their lovely child, trying everything from Ritalin, LSD, and ABA shock therapy, which I've pretty much gone through all of those. Kanner's studies even led to a misinformed claim that autism was an epidemic, and when more cases started to emerge, some doctors tried to track down Asperger's studies. In the 1950s, society often pushed ableism against disabled folks, including autistics. Misconceptions and stigmatization was rampant due to the fact that there was very little understanding of it back then. Autistics were still put in mental institutions since there was a lack of awareness and support for their unique needs. Because of pop psychology and new thought, prevailing attitudes focused on conformity, and obviously those who didn't fit societal norms were often marginalized. The broader push for civil rights in the 60s had ripple effects on various marginalized groups, including individuals with disabilities. Advocacy for equal rights and opportunities gained momentum as the religious right even pushed back on people with disabilities as well as women and colored folks. But there is some betterish news. Psychologist Bernard Rimland was a leading figure who helped change perceptions of autism. In 1964, he published the book Infantile Autism, The Syndrome and Its Implications for a Neural Theory of Behavior. This book challenged the prevailing view that autism was causing bad parenting. Rimland's work contributed to a more scientific understanding of autism, while neurologist and author Oliver Sacks wrote extensively on neurological conditions. Sacks brought attention to the diverse ways the human brain can function. Even though the book didn't focus specifically on autism, his work, such as The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, contributed to a broader understanding of neurological differences and helped to stigmatize conditions that were often overlooked and misunderstood. Soon, parents of autistic children played a crucial role in advocating for their children's rights and challenging societal attitudes towards autism and ASD. During this period, some parents formed advocacy groups and networks to share information and support, contributing to a growing awareness of the needs of autistic individuals. But unfortunately, the medical model of disability had prevailed, viewing autism as a disorder that needed to be fixed rather than recognizing and accommodating neurodiversity. This contributed to the exclusion and discrimination faced by individuals with autism during that period. This led people to encourage the government to call for the 1975 Education for All Handicapped Children Act, which mandated that children with disabilities, including autism, receive a free and appropriate education in the least restrictive environment. This marked a significant shift towards inclusive education and acknowledgement of diverse learning needs. Autistics began to advocate for themselves, and organizations like the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, or ASAN, who was a big help with this episode, by the way, big shout out, they emerged in the 21st century, built upon the foundation laid by earlier self-advocacy efforts. This even led to the Americans with Disabilities Act, which gave more rights to disabled individuals while discouraging discrimination in various aspects of public life, including employment and access to public facilities like bathrooms. These events collectively contributed to a changing narrative around autism, fostering greater awareness, acceptance, and inclusion in society, even amongst many Christian children. However, it's essential to note that challenges and stereotypes persisted, including one specific myth we'll be covering, the myth that autism was caused by vaccines. Dear listener, I know this is going to be really hard. The name Andrew Wakefield, it triggers ton of varied responses. So what I'm going to do is a quick run through of how the debunked belief in autism being caused by vaccines has still preserved, and the hatred towards people like myself and my people still goes on today. For those who are not familiar, Andrew Wakefield's controversial study in 1998 falsely claimed a connection between the MMR vaccine and autism. The study, based on a very small sample size, lacks scientific precision, and soon after, subsequent research with larger and more reliable samples refuted Wakefield's findings, and his work faced severe criticism for ethical violations and flawed methods of study. Multiple large-scale studies have consistently demonstrated the safety of vaccines, reinforcing the importance of immunization in preventing serious diseases. And yes, this includes the COVID vaccine, which, and I have no idea why I have to say this and go on a rant, the COVID vaccine will not turn anyone into zombies. And if you believe this, you believe that autistic individuals are zombies. And that is extremely insulting. Okay, deep breath. back to Wakefield as a result of his misconduct. Wakefield lost his medical license. While the scientific community knows how crucial it is to base health conditions on well-established scientific evidence, there is a new rise in conspirituality that picked up after Donald Trump tweeted his own belief in 2014 that vaccines made kids autistic. And because more and more people are becoming hesitant towards Big Pharma, more and more people are becoming hesitant towards vaccines, but not just because they fear becoming autistic. They also have positive reasons for avoiding vaccines, especially when it comes to allergies. But sadly, Wakefield has jumped on the anti-vaccine bandwagon and is celebrated amongst COVID contrarian groups. Whether we're talking about autistics on TikTok being harassed by the Freedom Convoy protesters, pastors like Greg Locke calling autistic children demons, or incels yelling about Greta Thunberg being rendered a leftist puppet who can't speak for herself, all these falsehoods and today's annoying neurodiverse persecution can be traced back to not only Wakefield, but Galton, Pompano, and Dobson as well. When I was 6 years old, my parents took me to what I think is a child psychologist. They noticed that I didn't do well with eye contact and social interaction with kids in the private school I was attending. They also didn't like that I was bullied by kids in my neighborhood who went to the public school next door to the private school. Now, I'm not sure what happened, but between 6 and 9, this thought kept on running through my brain. It was a thought that I'd have to eventually go out and save Winnipeg from bad people. Bad people that went to public schools, bad teachers that were hurting kids, bad kids that were bullying innocent kids. This soon led to me drawing cartoon heroes, taking on caricatures of the people who bullied me in my St. Vital neighborhood, and imaginary sidekicks helping me clean up the city. There was blood, there was gore, there were girlfriends, even though there was no sex, and I drew it all in the style of Charles Schulz, who draws Charlie Brown and Snoopy, or Scott Adams, who draws Dilbert. It was almost like I was an amateur Jack Chick before I even knew what he was or what those really disturbing tracks were. And you'd think I was just a normal kid trying to exercise my frustrations through drawing, but this part of a disturbing ideology is what was stuck in my brain for decades. It took me years to shake off the repetitive fact that I was constantly believing and the feedback loop that I was stuck in, that I felt that I was chosen, that I was a hero, that I was given divine purpose. No one told me this. There was no burning bush, there was no 40 days of me wandering through a desert. There was no divine dream or getting knocked off my bike on the way to private school and being visited by some bright light saying, "Why do you persecute me?" I just woke up one day and decided that I was going to be great. And I held on to these weird thoughts for over 30 years. Like affirmations, I kept repeating those things to myself whenever I was alone, whenever I was teased by kids at school. I was using those affirmations to soothe myself whenever I failed at something. I did repetitive motions to keep my body from telling me I was wrong. I kept trying to perform as a musician whenever there was a talent show, or to keep drawing cartoons whenever there was some sort of art thing happening in the city, and to submit my art to those particular events for display. I tried to be the best at sports like basketball, badminton, or football. I kept on trying to dress attractive for the girls. I did all these things out of an obsession that I was chosen and that I would stand out and that I would become somebody. Somebody special. Somebody the spotlight deserved. But then it dawned on me. It dawned on me that what some autistic individuals like to do is to build a world that is suited to what they want or what they can do. Because for some really odd reason, they just don't fit. And everyone else knows it, except themselves. I realized that the perfect world I wanted to be in doesn't exist, because this world that I'm presently in is neurotypical and I'm not. In 2019, I discovered there were two modes that I operated on. One mode involved masking, where I had to try to be normal just to fit in, to make friends, to contribute where I can. I joined bands, I tried to be all things to all people at my desk jobs, I never said no, I worshiped the right way with my hands raised at church. The other mode was where I spent my spare time trying to turn the world non-neurotypical. I did it by trying to enforce black and white rules even in gray areas. I did it by making hip-hop albums where I would preach about what was wrong with the world in my own eyes and how it needed to be made my way. I played the victim on social media when I was trolled while advocating for my needs as a disabled person. And I tried to stop my wife from publishing certain content that wasn't conservative or that was way too neurotypical. I realized that while operating in both of these modes, nothing ever went my way. So I had to figure out how to live in this world without feeling like my life is completely meaningless, completely mismanaged, and full of failure. I tried reading books by Eckhart Tolle, Stephen Covey, and yes, Tony Robbins. They all just seemed so stupid and full of mumbo-jumbo to me, as I probably implied in a previous episode. But then I came across one book and it changed everything. The Subtle Art of Not Giving a by Mark Manson. While the book does have a few things in it that I would strongly disagree with, especially in terms of personal responsibility, through Mark's wisdom, I was able to figure out that a world that was saved from what I thought was evil is a completely shallow and juvenile desire. I realized it was wrong for me to believe that I was special and chosen to take on an evil that I thought was bad. I learned instead that life can be beautiful, even if one is just an average person trying to get from one day to the next. I realized that it's perfectly fine not to succeed in everything I try and do. But most importantly, I learned that when we have poor values like I did for most of my life, like many evangelicals do, we put priority over things that don't matter or on useless or harmful things that make our life much worse, like trying to get rid of people who we're uncomfortable with that could make our lives easier, or having babies to ensure ideologies don't fade out. But when we choose better values, we slowly work on prioritizing things that actually matter. Like ensuring our community that our tribe is in thrives, like helping our families, like self-care and creativity, and guiding the world through a sad, unfortunate reality where suffering is inevitable. I also had no choice but to learn that as a disabled individual, I can fight for rights all I want, but most likely a good chunk of my needs won't be met. Even if I see the world progress ahead for the neurodiverse community in general. And it's all sad stuff that I struggle with every single day, but that doesn't necessarily mean that I'm going to live a life that's fruitless and full of regret on my deathbed. What I had to come to terms with was that my entire life, I was either surrounded by people who wanted to be special just like me, or they were already special and kept trying to stay ahead of everyone else. When accounting for the fact that the religion or the cult I grew up with tried to keep me under control, it also tried to tell me that when my time comes, I'll become a king's kid or a royal priesthood or a holy nation that God has called me to be. Perhaps I somehow absorbed that promise subconsciously from being in a Pentecostal environment as a young child, and that needed to be broken in order for me to experience freedom and healing. So I decided during the pandemic, and I'm trying to exercise this now, I've decided to try and balance things between surviving, creating good art and cool podcasts, and bringing that out to people and helping other people wherever I can. And you know what? So what if I have bad social skills, or I don't have tact when I speak, or I'm completely depressed a lot? So what if I stim with my hair or beatbox randomly, or I just want to be alone most of the time, or I struggle with my hands when it comes to doing cognitive tasks and stuff? I mean, as long as I'm not hurting people, I think I'm living okay. I think autism and neurodiversity deep down is still considered very unacceptable by the mainstream these days. And even with resources like the Autism Advocacy Network or books like Neurotribes or tons of programs in England and the US dedicated to mental health and wellness, I find that up here in Canada where I am, things like autism, dyspraxia, or other neurological issues, they aren't taken very seriously by governments or any of our systems at all. And as someone on the spectrum, struggling all the time, every program I've dealt with to get a proper neurodivergent diagnosis, psychological assessment, or work placement for someone with disabilities, it's only left me falling through the cracks. And a lot of other people are experiencing this as well. And because I feel university and colleges are not even trying to openly study this stuff, let alone help people that are on the spectrum or are neurodiverse, neurodiverse communities, the persecution towards us is getting worse. And we're already seeing it in the way the East Coast in Canada has to deal with rumors of students wanting to be cats. We already see it in the way Maxime Brenier talks about Greta. And in North American and European countries, we've dealt with all kinds of hate, black hate, LGBTQ hate, Palestinian hate, and trans hate, but now? I believe that just based on this rapid rise of populism and neoliberalism over the past 8 years, and based on the eugenics history that I've outlined in this episode, autistics will probably be next. This will lead to ableism being legalized, at least up here in Canada, because our country, even our liberal governments at provincial and federal levels, they've all focused on the cure and not the humanity of neurodiversity. Other people will be targeted just because they say they have ADHD or anxiety, and at worst they'll be in camps, and at best they'll be on welfare, struggling to find jobs, and may become the new faces of lazy system moochers who don't take personal responsibility. See, I think because of pop psychology, New Thought, racism, eugenics, and even Vendel and DeVos's ideas of blessing versus poverty that we covered in the previous MLM episode, almost everyone involved with religion in America has decided for themselves what is healthy and what is sickness. I think this is why some Christians see autism as a physical thing that needs to be healed or a demon that needs to be cast out. And even if they see an autistic child as chosen or blessed, they may not cast out the demon or ask God to heal the child. But Christians and evangelicals are only doing the bare minimum to understand how to deal with different kinds of brain wiring, how to deal with different kinds of responses to society, and how to deal with different responses to certain social situations and diverse ways of viewing religion itself, because people in religious institutions were conditioned by all these mindsets in the history that we covered today. But they don't want to face that fact. They don't want to face the history. And they don't want to face it because they're afraid. They don't want to face history because any origin story besides the portrait of a perfect, eternal, Jesus-loving community may cause that community or its ideologies to crumble into pieces. We keep hearing this commentary that, oh, we never had autism back in the day, we never had trans kids, we never had this whole, you know, insert woke thing here. Shut up. Like, they say we've never had these weird things in the past. This commentary is coming from Christians that are so scared of things they could easily understand. That fear could be something to heal from if Christians just take some time and listen to innocent different people they don't know or are uncomfortable with. If they just listen to them speak, they'll experience healing from that fear. And if they just took some time to listen to experts in their churches who do work in science, math, psychology, sociology, and other kinds of fields in universities, that will also help them to deal with that fear that they have. And also, you may have never had autism in your childhood growing up, but if you're saying those things, you didn't always have your perfect, neurotypical, nostalgic childhood that you grew up with either. And that's one of the points I'm trying to make with this whole podcast. What's more insane than telling an entire country who should rule over it? Telling an entire country that every enemy of its ideology comes from things in it that they don't understand. It's just one of the many, many reasons why religious zealots consider actual, true, and verified dark history as one of their enemies. Despite all of this, the belief that autistic individuals are demon-possessed, it's not representative of all Christians or religious communities. Modern understanding emphasizes neurobiological factors in conditions like autism, and a good number of Christians today approach autism and other developmental neurological differences with compassion and support. I understand that perspectives on autism within Christianity, as in any religious or cultural group, it can be diverse. But the unfortunate reason eugenics needed to be touched on in this episode, dear listener, is because many individuals, or for sure some groups like people who attend Greg Locke's church, they interpret certain biblical passages or teachings in a way that leads them to seek healing or intervention for various kinds of neurodiverse mental health conditions, whether we're talking about ADHD, mutism, schizophrenia, or autism itself. Today, Christians on the more progressive side embrace neurodiversity and believe that differences in neurodevelopment are part of the diversity of being fearfully and wonderfully made in God's image. And yet, it's so difficult for autistics to form community because of how different they feel they are, or how different they actually are compared to everyone else, while everyone else knows it but doesn't necessarily say anything. And because autistics are so honest with no strings attached, they fall easily into the traps of gaslighting and sexual abuse. It sometimes gets to a point where they become so easy to control just because they don't understand how high-control religion works. And yet, Christians ask why autistic individuals always seem to leave the church when they realize how hurt and abused they actually are. The thing is that when an individual wants a safe family because they're lonely, they want a community where they belong. But when an individual wants a perfect family because they are angry, they want people to control. Which leads me to a big reason my wife and I left Christianity. It was because in our environments that we grew up with that were religious, most Christians look down upon things like autism, ADHD, dyspraxia, bipolar disorder, and dyslexia. some evangelicals need to know that these things should be considered as naturally occurring cognitive variations that actually aren't sicknesses. Some of the different ways of processing the world and seeing it differently actually produce distinctive strengths that contribute to the progress and better health of culture and technology. These characteristics are not dysfunctions, they're not full of demons, and they're not sicknesses that need to be cast out in Jesus' name. Neurodiversity can't be controlled or misappropriated or manipulated by any neurotypical institution, whether it be governments, the system, our economy, or the church itself. Instead of viewing autism and other so-called disorders as errors of nature to be terminated or cast out, instead of showing autism as some damn puzzle to be solved, the church and all of society needs to see all of these qualities as valuable ingredients of human genetics. And yes, I'm aware that there are certain things that cause life to be harder for those who are neurodiverse. So, at the same time, evangelicals should have been the leading group in seeking to make the features of autism that are severely disabling much more bearable with adequate support and accommodations. Maybe if churches actually started focusing on helping people that are struggling with their neurodiverse wiring instead of being ableist, teaching pop psychology, whining about vaccines or moral panics or solving bad parenting. If they stopped doing all those things, maybe society will be more accommodating. In the future, rather than investing millions and trillions of dollars in efforts to uncover the causes of autism or support eugenics groups like Autism Speaks, our entire society should help and welcome autistic people and their families in their circles to live happier, healthier, and more productive and secure lives right here, right now. Autism can be a disability for some or a needed feature for others. But either way, it calls for support. It's not a children's disease that can be cured. There are many adults who struggle with autism. Many of them go undiagnosed. And sometimes, that undiagnosed autism is not because they sinned or because they're lazy or irresponsible, and they definitely are not zombies or, dare I say, retarded. In fact, don't even use that word in public. People who are neurodiverse are people just like you and me, struggling to live a full life. Because I'm on the spectrum, I need to come out and say it. We're autistic. We've always existed. We've been here in the past, we're still here now, and will exist in the future. We're still fighting for our right to exist like almost every other group that isn't white. We're doing all this on top of trying to regulate our bodies. We're doing all this on top of fighting sensory overload. We're doing this while trying to keep our brains stable if overloaded with information, and we're fighting to keep on living because we deserve to live full lives. We're going to see tomorrow, whether it's through pushing for accessibility or even just trying to get our foot in the door for a damn job interview. My name is Aaron Parsons. I am autistic. I'm not a person with autism. I'm proud of who I am and what I'm capable of and the things I can do thanks to my neurodiverse brain. And I deserve to live a full, fruitful life filled with happiness, adventure, friends, family, and a life that will make the world a better place, even if that world doesn't remember my name after I die.